Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, and welcome to the Randomly Generated History Club, where three non-historians pick a year at random and try to learn things about it. I'm Anna, and I'm here with my two friends, Will and Ant.
Hi there.
Hello.
So, before we get to this week's year, want to address the, some would say, glaring historical whoopsie of last week, wherein Ant famously covered the year 527 CE instead of the actual chosen year, which was, of course, more than a millennium earlier. Ant, I believe you got several angry emails about that.
Yeah, lots of emails, messenger foxes, a lot. I am so sorry. One came in from a listener named Carlene, who mentioned that in addition to none of us catching the references to Christianity, the Byzantine Empire, I also talked about the years going up in chronological order, which, as it turns out, doesn't happen in the years before zero. They descend instead. Carlene offered some helpful suggestions for suitable punishments, including A, pouring molten gold down my throat. B, throwing me in the Tiber in a sack with a monkey and a rooster. C, defenestrating me. Or D, other.
Oh, God. No bad choice there.
No. So please, I deserve them all. I do.
And please do write in, listeners, with the punishment that you think the RNG should inflict upon Ant for his grievous error. I hadn't quite picked up on the numbers going up rather than down.
It turns out, Will, you and I are not, you know, absolved from blame.
Yeah, you're in the sack with me.
We're in the sack with you and the rooster. Good. Okay. This week, we're talking about the year 1795.
Great year.
Yeah, one of the classics.
Top vintage.
Top vintage, Grand Cru. I'd like our three-word previews. Ant, you can go first.
Bye-bye, Poland.
Okay. Nice. All right. Oh, that's really funny, given what I'm going to say. Will?
Walking pace warfare.
Walking pace warfare, bye-bye, Poland. And my three words are aloha, prophesied king.
Oh, aloha to you.
Aloha.
The great Hawaiian prophecy is foretold. And
well, you're going to have to find out.
I will.
In fact, you can find out right now. So, yes, I am in Hawaii today. As you can tell.
Yeah, I can tell from the background of your video.
The look how beautiful lapping. And tan I am.
Oh, it's great.
Specifically, I'm in Hawaii in the 1700s. Mm. Still beautiful, but this is the ancient period of Hawaii, which existed from the time of the first settlers who came via long-distance canoe from islands in the South Pacific, which is crazy.
Yeah. Huge distances.
Like, just immense and incredible.
I've only ever medium distance canoed myself.
yeah, you just down the Thames.
Yeah, just down the Thames.
It's not clear to me how that all happened.
Yeah, no, nor I. It is. It seems unfathomable that it happened. I mean, thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
But that's actually not what I'm talking about today.
Oh, okay.
But maybe one day I will talk about it. This is just some context. So the four biggest islands in the archipelago were each ruled by their own supreme ruler, and there really wasn't much coalition or cooperation between them during the ancient period. In 1778, James Cook makes the first known contact between the Europeans and the Hawaiian Islands. Mm-hmm. Ends poorly for him, but more importantly, it is the beginning of the end of the ancient period of Hawaii. And today's main character is a man named Kamehameha, who was the nephew of the king of Hawaii, by which I mean the Big Island.
Okay.
And this is a thing that will come up again and again.
Yeah.
Hawaii is the whole archipelago, and it's also the Big Island.
Okay.
So I'll try to be clear about that. The historical record is unsure of when Kamehameha was actually born. But like this, some sources imply that it was in 1758, because that's when Halley's Comet was seen.
Ah.
And they like to associate him with the comet, as we've discussed on past episodes. What we do know is that he was raised in the royal court of his uncle, and he was given a very prominent religious position as the guardian of the Hawaiian god of war, as well as control of a big district on the island of Hawaii. And after his uncle died, Kamehameha's cousin Kiwalao became king. But from the early days of his reign, their relationship was strained. Kamehameha was already getting the allegiance of some of the chiefs around the island, and his cousin starts to see him as a threat.
But he had the god of war on his side, right?
He did. He was closely associated with the god of war, who did come in handy later on. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, what are they going to do? Gather the gods of, like, you know, like cooking and... farming. I mean, they're defenseless.
Well, there are other ones, but they chose some more mortal methods to settle their scores. One point of friction, though, does revolve around an ancient legend. So in Hawaii, there's a stone called the Naha Stone. It's this massive piece of volcanic rock. It weighs 7,000 pounds.
Oof.
And historically, the stone had lots of legends attached to it, including one that said if any man was able to overturn the stone, mm-hmm. he would be granted the power to unify all of the Hawaiian Islands.
Wow. Well, that's how I unified them, but I flipped it over
you
again.
You flipped it back over. Yeah. You're like, yeah, you know what? I'm fine.
Yeah.
So Kamehameha is fascinated by this legend, and mm-hmm. sources claim that at the age of 14, after several failed attempts, he was able to flip it over.
No, he wasn't.
I don't know.
People in the UK are critical of the first past the post voting system, but say what you like about it. It is superior to stone flipping as a method of
selection. If I could find a politician who was capable of flipping over a 7,000-pound stone, I would back them to do a lot of different
things. I think you can topple a lot. You know, a human can topple a lot.
Yeah, but it's not it's not topple.
Liz Truss toppled the economy in, like, whatever, eight weeks.
Yeah, and the economy of Britain is worth about 7,000 pounds.
We're cutting all this. We're not allowed to talk about anything else.
Anyway, so Kamehameha thinks he's the chosen one, and he kind of goes all in on this quest to unite the islands. In 1790, something called the Oluwalu Massacre happens. It's honestly probably worth its own episode, but in a nutshell, two American fur trading ships come to Hawaii. The captain of one of them is somehow offended by something a Hawaiian chief does, and so he flogs him. Violence escalates quickly on both sides, culminating in the Americans tricking some villagers into thinking that they're there to trade, but secretly arming their ship's cannons and firing on the villagers as they're approaching the ship.
That's not cricket.
It's not great. They kill 100 villagers off the ship, which was ironically called the Fair American.
It was not. Was it really?
I swear it was called that. Yeah.
That's poetic.
Well, one was called Esmeralda, one was called Fair American. The Hawaiians get revenge and take the Fair American ship. They kill all its crew, save for a couple people. And the chief who captures the ship delivers it to Kamehameha, who lets the two American survivors, a guy named John Young and a guy named Isaac Davis, stay alive and come to work for him as his advisors. Is this
the John Young of Disney fame?
That's John Smith,
I think.
That's
John Smith.
Oh, never mind then.
And wow. Also no, but...
Yeah. No, you are wrong sort of geographically and historically.
And temporally.
You're off by...
It's almost about 100 years off.
A century and a half, I would say. Yeah.
Well then.
Time for somebody to watch Pocahontas again. That great documentary. So he lets these two survivors come on and be his advisors. So now Kamehameha has a ship with modern cannons. And he's got two advisors who are well-versed in modern warfare, and he's ready to start his war for unification of the islands. And later that year, which again, we're in 1790 still, he invades the island of Maui. Using his cannons and the advice of his advisors, he defeats the army of Maui, but doesn't yet depose Maui's chief. He goes back to Hawaii, the big island, and kicks it for a while, but then in 1795...
The year in question.
Yes. I did it, guys. You did it. A thing happened in the year. he tries again. He sails to Maui with an armada of 960 war canoes and 10,000 soldiers. And this time he easily takes Maui along with another smaller island.
How many people do you get in a war canoe?
I think you get roughly 10,000 divided by 960 people.
So between one and two.
Yeah.
per canoe. I thought you said 1,000 canoes,
no,
900 people.
10,000 soldiers, 960 war canoes.
Yeah, that's like, it's like 1,000 canoes, 10,000 people. Yeah.
100 people each.
10 people each.
Okay, what range are we talking about?
About 10 or 11
people
each. Are they
10 medium range or 100 long range ones? Because I think we could do them. What? Okay, you don't know this. There could just be one really big canoe.
That's true.
With like 9,900 people in it.
Well, so in your mind, there's like, say, 20 small scout canoes.
Yes,
small. And then one mega canoe.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they're like the little like cleaner fish on the on the belly of a whale.
It's just a single person skiff and then a massive, massive one that they're tugging along.
It would have to be so long if they're all in a line.
Well, yeah,
it'd be like 400 feet long.
Honestly, at that point, you could probably just build the canoe as a bridge between Hawaii and Maui.
But canoe tactics dictate that you should always be in a line, so when people are standing directly in front of you, they only see one canoe.
Right, yeah, and they don't know how big it is. Yeah. It's like, is that a scout canoe or a mega canoe?
You'll never know.
Or a bridge canoe?
A bridge canoe. This is, you know how much I love talking about different kinds of ships and boats. I am going to table this discussion. Yeah. And say that a number of canoes and people made it to Maui.
Weird.
And Kamehameha takes the island. He turns to Oahu, unaware that one of his own chiefs has defected and is helping the chief of Oahu prepare for battle. But jokes on them, Kamehameha's troops still win, including at one point by forcing 400 of the Oahu troops to jump off a 1,000-foot-tall cliff.
Okay, so that's about 2 and a bit feet per person. Average height of a person, 5'5", let's say.
Yeah.
They could have, had they adopted the canoe tactics, just hand and footed it to each other and just lowered each other gently down, and a few people would survive.
That's true. Your math checks out on that one. You've redeemed yourself.
I think I have. Thank you very much.
Unfortunately, that's not what happened. Oh. They pushed them all off the cliff. At this point, the only main island left to conquer is Kauai, which Kamehameha attempts to take, but is turned back by a storm and a plague that decimates his army. But still, even though he's only got 3 out of the 4 main islands, 1795 is considered the start date of the Hawaiian kingdom.
Ah. Okay.
Yeah. 15 years later, in 1810, he negotiates peaceful unification with Kauai and Niihau, which were the last two islands, and this completes the unification of all the Hawaiian islands.
Oh, nice.
It's a little unclear what happened in the intervening 15 years, but presumably the other islands saw that things were going well.
Well, they had to wait for all the trees to regrow from the thousands of canoes they've been making.
Yeah. Exactly. As a ruler, Kamehameha unified Hawaii's legal system. He promoted trade with Europe and the U.S. The U.S. in particular became Hawaii's chief trading partner and kind of watched over it to prevent Britain and Japan from being dominant. Mm. Of course, this would eventually be to the detriment of the Hawaiians, as about a century later, the U.S. would overthrow the kingdom and then eventually annex Hawaii as the 50th state.
Thanks for watching over us.
Yeah, they watched over us so good that they just took the whole place. Classic. And as one final note about this, I very briefly wanted to mention the Hawaiian flag, because this is a great piece of trivia. Mm. It's the only U.S. state flag that has the flag of another country on it. Huh. So the Hawaiian flag has the Union Jack in the top left-hand corner.
Okay.
Union flag.
Union flag.
Yeah. No, a Union Jack is only a Union Jack if it's on a ship. It's
yeah, but so it was. Otherwise. So this...
So the Hawaiian flag is always on a ship?
Well... The origins of it,
okay.
It was an ensign. It was like a standard of a ship that, so various British admirals were in the mix and were operating in Hawaii, and Kamehameha had generally good relations with the Royal Navy. And mm-hmm. so at one point they gave him a standard from the ship.
Okay.
And the Hawaiians liked it so much that eventually they just... accepted that as their official flag, and that has remained even after the annexation.
Mm-hmm. That's incredible.
Yeah, so it's a British looking flag in the top left hand corner, and then red, white, and blue stripes that I think represent the different.
I guess like some of the other Polynesian states have British flags in the top left
not for the same reason, because they're actually British possessions. This was like it was never a British possession, but. They still just really liked. I mean, to your credit, it's a cool looking flag.
Yeah,
right. It's pretty cool.
But yeah, that was
brings a tear to my eye.
Every time you raise in the morning while you play the trumpet,
exactly. Which is actually really hard to get both the trumpet playing and the raising of the flag at the same time.
It is pretty. But you can only play like the three notes, I guess, from one hand.
But my zeal for king and country,
yeah.
forced me to
as you do do re mi.
The really impressive thing would be if you could also make yourself a cup of tea as you did all of this. But you'll get there.
Well, that was really interesting.
Yeah, so that's just a little bit about Hawaii.
Well, I also found it interesting.
Great.
Good validation.
I win.
So I'm going to talk about Poland. And
Hawaii of Europe.
The Hawaii of Europe. It's got the classic Hawaii goulash and stew. Classic beach food.
Who doesn't love a hot goulash in the sun?
Exactly. But this is about the third and the final partition of Poland. Mm. And when we say partition, this is the splitting up of Poland among the three great powers that surrounded it at the time, which is Russia, Prussia, and the Habsburgs of Austria.
Okay.
So the three states. The real heart of the matter was an excessive bout of proto-democracy.
I had proto-democracy last year.
Because there was a law.
There's a vaccine now.
There's a law that was enacted whereby nobles were seen as equals to each other and therefore could all vote, and they could all importantly veto any laws that they wish.
Mm.
And this was called the Liberium Veto.
Liberian?
Liberium, or Liberium.
Oh, okay.
Liberum Veto.
Okay.
Maybe my Latin is wrong here. But what that really means is that nothing got done.
Yeah.
So there was just a stagnant political state, because any law or decree was shot down by those that didn't want it. You know, it was like, oh, we want to raise taxes? No. Oh, we want to lower taxes? No. Oh, we want to expand our territory? No. Oh, we want to shrink our territory? No. People could just shoot down everything. It was, frankly, democracy gone mad.
You know what they needed is an improv coach who would come in and yes, teach them about how to yes and.
So, the interesting thing was, though, that this veto power also meant that foreign powers could easily influence the outcomes and their incomes of the Poland-Lithuanian sort of commonwealth, as it was known. So Poland and Lithuania together. Because they could bribe nobles to exercise their right to veto to suit their aims. Poland-Lithuania, before the partitions, are already in a state of disorder then, and not really kind of a completely sovereign state, because they're effectively this puppet vassal state of being controlled by, you know, Russian czars. So, influencing elections since 1795, really.
Yep.
This applies particularly to the last Commonwealth king, King Stanislaw August Poniatowski, I'm so sorry, who was formerly a lover of the Russian Empress Catherine the Great.
Ooh.
And he was heavily influenced by Russia. So Prussia, Russia, and Austria were delighted to have this wealthy state basically in their grips, and they created a secret alliance called the Alliance of the Three Black Eagles.
Cool
That's
name.
That's pretty cool.
Really cool, because they all had black eagles on their flags, and Poland had a white eagle. So they vowed to use their influence to ensure the laws of Poland would not change by exerting bribery and, I guess, like, I don't know, you know, hooking up with the king, apparently, or whatever they needed to do. So during the 7 Years' War, though, and this is all kind of, you know, there was this kind of effective political stalemate there. But during the 7 Years' War, which is 1756 to 1763, the Commonwealth of Poland, Lithuania officially remained neutral towards the warring French, Prussia, English. It was a very big, big war. We're not going to go into it. However, due to their allegiances to Russia, they allowed Russians to use its western lands as a base of operations for them to harry the Prussians. As a result, Prussians not so happy.
Hang on, were they already in the Alliance of the Black Eagles?
They were already
time?
In the alliance as well. So there's a lot of,
ooh,
a lot of, I would say, skullduggery.
Skullduggery, the betraying of your fellow Black Eagles.
Yeah, yeah, the Black Eagles flock together.
Yeah,
or not in the
not.
Case.
Not. Yeah, yeah.
And so the Prussian king Frederick II ordered that the Polish currency, they would manufacture so much weight of like of counterfeit currency that it effectively collapsed the economy.
Oh.
So much of the currency just couldn't be spent.
I guess, you could do that back then.
Yeah.
And it's just really interesting. This whole part of like this whole thing is like sub-threshold warfare. It's not exactly, you know, overt, but it's crippling this state politically and economically. So the Russians in return, though, they use their influence to enact constitutional change in Poland and Lithuania to pass rules that the veto power was an inalienable right. You cannot get rid of this veto power because it suited them very well.
I veto that.
And they expelled Prussian sympathizers, and they also made a decree that Russians were allowed to be safely housed, their troops could move freely, and they could hold any office, including king. And they established the Russian Orthodoxy as an official religion as well. So they're really just like, you know, Poland was politically, economically, culturally, and religiously eroded. And this led to the partitions. So this is when they start carving up the land. So the Habsburgs of Austria, the Prussians and the Russians just agreed amongst themselves which lands they would get. So the three black eagles descending on Poland. There were skirmishes and battles to prevent this, but nonetheless, the first partition saw about 30% of the land and about half the population, from one day to the next, no longer being Polish/Lithuanian. They were now part of Prussia.
Wow.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So, and then they demanded that King Stanislaw ratify this annexation. But he refused until they marched into Krakow, and then he had no choice but to sort of meekly agree. So, yeah, it's yours. Yeah. Take 30%.
I mean, it was actually crazy that they asked the king, hey, can you sanction the fact that we've taken half of your people and a third
insane.
Of your land?
And the second partition followed suit. It's very similar, 1790, where once again, declarations of annexation led to a further reduction of the Commonwealth, whereby these troops said, hey, we wrote this letter saying we own you now.
Yeah.
And it was, again, the population of Poland and Lithuania was down to 30% of what it once was. So they had just carved out a massive swathes of land. So at this stage, enough was enough. Enter the hero of the tale, a fascinating man called Tadeusz Kazukuzo. Oh gosh,
fascinating man. Fascinating.
Tadas, fascinating. I'm so sorry.
No, I mean it's great.
He was a Polish military engineer.
Okay.
He was a military leader and a statesman, and he believed that the constitution of the original lands of Poland should be maintained, and that if they banded together, they restore what they call the golden liberty of the Commonwealth, as in like this, you know, Poland-Lithuania is Polish-Lithuanian. Prior to this, where he got these funny old ideas of, you know, independence, North America.
You're welcome.
Yeah. He was a colonel in the American Revolutionary War.
Oh, sweet.
And he was a close friend of one Thomas Jefferson.
Oh.
Yeah. So he got some crazy ideas from Tommy J, but he brought them back with him.
Old TJ.
He designed West Point.
Is that true?
He designed West Point, and he was promoted to Brigadier General in the U.S. Army.
Okay. At that point, the Americans were promoting anyone.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was legit, though. He was, like, super legit. He comes back to Poland, hoping to stir revolution against those these partitions.
Was that a discontented sigh?
Yeah, his head's full of dangerous ideas.
Well, he comes back, and he launches the Kosako Uprisings in 1794. This is in the backdrop where not only were the lands being confiscated and stuff, the army itself was being carved up. So the army from Poland at the time was about 36,000, and that was reduced to 15,000, totally demoralized. And those units were being conscripted into Prussian armies. So it was like, hey, you're now actually no longer Polish troops.
Did they have to then go fight their former army mates?
Potentially. Well, I mean, they weren't fighting Poland at the time, but if they're Russians and Prussians, potentially
they were fighting
Polish
each other.
Italians fighting each other. Yeah.
Wow.
Potentially. This was, you know, annoying for our mate Tadas, because he had never lost a battle before now, and he's seeing that the army was so denuded. But the original planners of the uprising were delighted to have this hero of the people, super popular guy on board. But he saw that it was extremely difficult to win. He knew it would be really tough against three, you know, superpowers around them when they're getting so denuded. And so for a while, he actually left for Italy to drum up support, make some plans. But things on the ground changed so dramatically, he had to launch the plans for uprising earlier than he would have liked. He gave the order, and 1,500 troops that were due to be drafted into the Russian army from Poland refused orders, downed tools, and rebelled. And this sparked outbreaks of violence against Russian troops throughout Poland. The result of this, as per the plan, was that the garrison that was in Krakow was emptied, and they went out to go and quell these uprisings, these rebellions.
Cool.
This left an undefended capital. The time was now.
Is it appropriate for me to chant USA?
No. Okay. I don't know that it ever is.
I think week by week on the podcast, I'm always ready to do it, and then I'm reminded of bad things.
Oh, gosh, yeah. He took to the streets, and he assumed the title of Commander-in-Chief of all the Polish forces, and vowed in a stirring speech not to use these powers to oppress any person, but to defend the integrity of the borders of Poland, regain the independence of the nation, and to strengthen universal liberties. He issued orders of conscription. One in every five house had to donate one man to the army, but they were very low
in
numbers.
One in every five houses had to donate a man.
Do they organise that between them?
I don't know. I mean,
it
took a while, the planning. He was in Italy, census and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But he was really unable to arm them properly, just didn't have enough armaments. So it was a peasant army full of scythes. There are the scythists or something like that. They had a name like that.
Oh, because they were just fighting with their farming implements.
Yeah, with farming scythes.
Because all the good,
tractors,
all the like professional
portable sheep
soldiers had been taken into the other, into Prussian and Russian armies.
Yeah. And you know, there's all this kind of fractured land, and it wasn't so much together.
I think you could do a lot of damage with a scythe.
Definitely.
Oh, 100%.
That's
you could.
A sharp blade.
It is. It's a sharp curved blade.
It's what death uses.
It is
good
what
enough
death
for
uses.
The Polish peasants.
Well, they made some early gains with their scythes. Of the 5,000 troops that were originally in the Krakow garrison, 2,000 to 4,000 of them were killed and the rest fled. So they just mopped up in the city. However, the Prussians and the Russians were mobilizing. They are not ones to trifle with. The approximate 9,000 soldiers and 6,000 peasants of the revolution were held up in the city, but they were outmatched by a mounted force of some 17,000 Prussians and 9,000 Russians. And that grew in time when there was 45,000 troops besieging Krakow. And
the scythes are going to have trouble against.
They had more scythes.
Yeah,
it was a scythe off, and there was definitely more
horse scythes.
And Tadas, the hero, was defeated at the Battle of Szczecinochnia.
Yep, sounds legit.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, I've been there.
I'm so sorry. It's very lovely this time of year. He was defeated there, and this obviously caused a bit of a collapse in morale. And Warsaw was also being besieged at the time, and after a few hours of brutal, brutal, brutal street-to-street battle, some 22,000 Russians broke through, looted, and burned Warsaw to the ground. The uprising was over. The power of Poland was broken. The three Black Eagles were cawing in victory over the spoils.
Feasting on the carrion of the White Eagle.
Exactly. And the third partition then soon followed, where the three great powers resigned to dissolve the notion of the state of Poland.
Wow.
So Poland's and its lands and Lithuania was completely split up and divided amongst them. You know, the profitable salt mines of the West went to Prussia. That's actually true.
Okay, yeah.
They had salt mines.
I like salt.
Yeah, everyone loves salt. Polish salt is the best. Mm. Yeah.
Tell me about it.
But yes, the lands were split up and Poland itself ceased to exist as a concept, as a nation for 123 years.
Wow.
Yeah, crazy. So Poland then, you know, it did come about again. Poland does exist to this day.
As
of recording of the podcast.
Yeah.
But yeah, and there's a very rich history of how this came about that comes in subsequent years, but that's not what we're covering today.
No.
And so, thus endeth my tale of the year of 1795 in Poland.
Okay, am I going to talk this week about the Battle of Genoa, also known as the Battle of Cape Noli, which was a naval battle fought between French and British forces.
Wet war.
With some...
that's what I call it.
Sorry, a wet war.
I call it wet wars. Yeah, naval battles. Yeah.
Which was a wet war fought between French and British forces. And there were some allies thrown in on the British side. But of course, it was led by the gallant British. And it took place on the 14th of March in 1795.
Wow, guys, we did it.
We did it. A full episode of things that happened in the year. RNG surely must reward us for this.
It's glowing with pride.
And it took place in the Gulf of Genoa during the French Revolutionary Wars. The French fleet was led by a French admiral called Pierre Martin.
Wet general.
I think we call him a water fighter.
The French fleet was led by a French water fighter called Pierre Martin, who had 14 ships of the line. And on the British side, the Royal Navy...
boats. Oh, wait, no, hang on.
You know why they were called ships of the line, right? Because they went in the line following the canoe tactics from earlier. How many ships are there? Don't know.
You have to look on them.
They're in a line.
Just looks like one.
And the Royal Navy was under a guy called Vice Admiral William Hotham, who had 13 ships of the line, or wet boats.
Well,
it doesn't really work, does
it? Yeah, as soon as I said it, I realized what I meant was like water tanks.
Water tanks.
Ah, okay, yeah. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Chariots of the oceans.
Yeah. Ocean tanks. Yeah,
ocean chariots.
Chariots of the ocean is very good.
And the battle, of course, otherwise I wouldn't be talking about it, ended with a British victory and the capture of two ships belonging to the perfidious French.
Can I ask one question of clarification?
Please.
You said this was during the French Wars of...
Revolutionary Wars.
French Revolutionary Wars. Why are the British involved?
Why? Well... from reading into this and from some dubious knowledge, but I believe it was a bit like the during the American Revolutionary Wars, there were parties on both sides.
Uh-huh.
There were loyalists and royalists.
Yes.
And then there were revolutionaries. And it was the same in the threat in France. So in France, there were revolutionary forces and then there were royalist forces.
Okay.
And I think the British intervened to try and prevent the Republicans.
Yeah, well, they don't want to, you know, the spread of democracy, liberty, egality and fraternity. You know, that doesn't suit the British monarchy whatsoever.
So I think this was still in that period when the British were trying to stop the Republicans succeeding.
Mm. Okay.
But like the White Russians supported the White Russians after that revolution.
Okay. Later. And maybe they are also like, oh, we can also just get Genoa, which would be cool.
Yeah. And also, probably just seize stuff as well.
Right.
So the battle was part of a wet war campaign that took place in the spring of 1795, during which the French admiral was trying to assert control over the waters off southern France, which had effectively been ceded to the British about a year and a half earlier when the British captured the French Mediterranean base of Toulon. So to talk a bit about the background, the French Revolutionary Wars were expanded hugely in early 1793, so a couple of years earlier, when this newly formed French Republic, just as we were talking about, decided to declare war on Britain. And this was, I assume, partly because Britain was doing what we said a moment ago, which is intervening again on the other side of the whole...
That is also just such a, like, immediately aggro act. Like, the French Republic only became a republic in 1789, and then 4 years later, they're like, you know what? Time to go after the British. Not like figure out how to be a republic.
You are starting to understand why nobody likes the French in Britain. Yeah.
This is the history of Fair Britain, enough. Which is basically that Britain has been sitting very quietly by itself in the North Atlantic, just trying to get by and trade. And other people, naughty people elsewhere, keep picking fights with us.
They were basically, it was Hobbiton is what it was. Just complete isolationists. Never cast us, you know, cast the first stone.
Just with their big hairy feet.
They stumbled into empire and colonialism.
And occasionally were called on to quest.
Yeah.
All right. You know what? Yes. Great. I feel fully informed.
So to defend British commercial interests in the context of having just been declared war on, the Royal Navy established a fleet and sent it down to patrol the Mediterranean trade lanes and sea lanes. So by 1795, the French had managed to rebuild their fleet. It took a couple of years to do it, which meant that the French didn't have to worry so much about avoiding a fight. They now felt they had roughly about enough forces to be able to find the British and fight them in the Mediterranean to try and assert their control of the Med.
They had enough forces?
Yeah.
I did think you said horses, and I got very confused.
Sorry, yes, ocean horses. And the British, on their side, were also kind of keen to meet this reformed French fleet as well, because at some point they had to defeat it. So both sides were pretty much up for a fight at this point, and just looking for the right opportunity. And the battle between the two fleets ended up happening in March 1795, as we've said, about 25 miles off Genoa. And on the day, though, the position that the French admiral was in was that he wasn't that happy because the British had an advantage with respect to the wind and were and obviously I'm not an expert. The weather vane. Mm-hmm.
Listen, if there's one thing I know the British can command, it's the wind and the rain. They do it all the time.
What do you know of the damp?
We were raised in the damp. So on the day, the French were basically trying to avoid battle, really, and the British were chasing them down. And the day started by 6:30 in the morning. As the sun came up, two British ships, the Bedford and the Captain, caught up with the French stragglers at the back of their fleet, and were both really quite badly damaged as they tried to fight their way into the main French body. And then, as both fleets started to encounter each other, the main bodies of both fleets started to encounter each other. They were then beset by a period of calm weather, which meant
of the British,
and that made manoeuvring really, really difficult. Yeah. And there was this kind of slow motion set of turns and attacks, and it's kind of comical if you read the history of lots of this of wet war battles from this period. Is that this is often what happened? You'd have two fleets approaching each other and coming together at about 6 miles an hour, just blasting the hell out of each other as they close that distance, which is both, you know, completely comical, frankly, but also you just had to take it and and try and fire your cannons as fast as you could, as accurately as you could, and just slowly close the distance.
This makes me think of the scene in Austin Powers when he's in the steamroller and the guy is like, no! And then you zoom out and he's going so slow. I'm just imagining the two ships coming at each other at such a crawl.
Yeah, that's it, except with cannons and hundreds of people dying.
Yeah. Well, that part is less funny.
And then over the course of the battle, the British eventually got the upper hand, of course, and prevailed. But critically, there was the opportunity at the end of the battle to press the attack even more that the British had and to chase down some of the escaping French. But the British commander, Vice Admiral Hotham, who we mentioned earlier, proclaimed, "Oh, we must be contented. We have done very well." But unfortunately, no amount of appeals from Nelson, who was on another vessel at the time, could convince him to continue the action and press it down. Yeah. And so the moment was lost, and the French did manage to slip away. The bulk of their forces did manage to slip away. So it was a British victory. And after the battle, the British and the Allied forces had losses that amounted to about 74 killed and about 284 wounded. And no one really got a full accounting for the French casualties. Yeah. Because of their lack of professionalism, probably.
And record keeping.
In numeracy.
But in the British accounts, it's listed as approximately 400 casualties. Wow. And the result was that although the battle was a British victory, Nelson was so scathing in private of the lack of aggression, and others were kind of critical as well of aggression, that the battle was slightly forgotten about, and then only 3 years later was massively overshadowed or paled into insignificance compared with the Battle of the Nile and these very, very famous naval victories that the British started to have against the French. And so as a result, it became a little forgotten, and it wasn't until the 1840s, 50 years later, that the British gave a medal ribbon to all the veterans so that they could actually commemorate the battle.
Joining us, that is everything you would ever need to know about 1795. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine anything else of relevance happened that year.
No.
If you have questions or comments, you can, as always, find us on Twitter, visit our website, randomlygeneratedhistory.com.
And also, please follow me on Twitter. I have 6 followers. I don't know what I'm doing.
Wow, brag.
It's at randomlyant. I've been tweeting Elon nearly daily. But now it is time to choose our next year. So, Will, please, can you boot up the random number generator?
I absolutely can. And as a reminder, we've set the random number generator to choose a year between 1000 BCE mm-hmm. and 2000 CE. Oh. There's a ticker tape coming out of the random number generator again. Oh, Let me just read it.
God.
It is in Morse code.
Does it just say, you guys are doing so great?
Yeah, take some time
dash,
off, maybe.
Dash, dot, dot. Oh, okay, so I think it says, Merry Christmas. Oh. Your next episode will be the first annual Christmas special.
Huh. Oh,
okay.
Interesting.
That is very interesting.
What do we think that means?
I guess we'll find out on the 20th of December.
This is exciting.
How very exciting. I'm jingling in anticipation.
History is coming.
Well, we'll see you then when we decipher the message for the first annual Christmas special.
Mm, great. See you next week.
Bye.
When we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.